closing argument. Walter Hudson. Pursuing happiness thoughtfully. 8 to 10 weeknights on Twin Cities News Talk. AM 1130 and 103.5 FM.
We may not all be magicians, but we do understand the basics of sleight of hand, at least the theory. Distraction plays a critical role. Get them looking at one thing while your other hand is busy doing something else. And politicians are fantastic at utilizing this tactic. You know, get you distracted over here, get you looking over here, and over there they're doing something insidious, often self-serving, and never in your interests. We're going to give you one such example here at the start of the show on Closing Argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Streaming at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and your iHeartRadio app. We are here 8 to 10 weeknights, Mondays being the seasonal exception with your hockey coach's programming. In studio with me tonight, Andrew Schmitz, Vice Chair of the Republican Liberty Caucus. Fantastic organization that I myself used to be involved in. Of course, you've heard Xavier Bickett on this air several times. In fact, he's going to be in tomorrow night to help us break down and analyze the State of the Union address. So be sure to tune into that right after your State of the Union, which will be aired live here on the program. Andrew, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Walter, and thanks for having me on to discuss this issue on the show.
Absolutely, and let's let people know what this issue is. So the legislature, you know, it's already against the law, according to my understanding, to drive while distracted.
Yes, that's a ticketable offense, to drive while distracted, but I think it's very much open to the interpretation of the officer issuing the ticket.
Which, you know, I could go down a rabbit hole of criticizing the status quo, but let's focus on what they're proposing to do moving forward here. There's a new bill in the works, and it is being pushed in bipartisan fashion, including by some noteworthy Republican legislators who are doing so proudly, to make it an even more costly offense for drivers to operate their cell phone in any capacity while driving. Tell us about it.
Okay, so I'm going to focus on the Senate files just to keep things simple. There's two Senate files. There's Senate file 91 and 75. Excuse me if I mix these up, but so one of them, the one that's Dave Osmek's bill, I'll start with the simple one. The Scott Newman bill, sponsored bill.
That's a Republican.
Both Republicans. Yeah. The Newman bill is a simple one. That one just bans making a phone call without a hands-free device. It requires using a hands-free device, and if you get caught not using a hands-free device, it's a $275 fine.
$275
for...
That's worse than a speeding ticket.
Yeah.
Significantly worse than a speeding ticket.
Yeah. Worse than, for holding a phone to your cheek while you're driving.
Right.
So that's the simple one. I think the text on that one's like one paragraph. The other one is a bit more complicated, and this is Osmek's, and I know he's been talking a lot about this for months, about what he wants to do. And what his does is, if you look through statute, there's a whole bunch of laws that say that if you cause a traffic accident and you have a few certain other conditions, you're guilty of some serious crimes. And those crimes are proportional to what happened in the accident, whether someone died, and then I believe they charge you with vehicular homicide, mm-hmm. or if you property damage or someone got, hurt and had to go to the hospital and gets a couple stitches or something, then the punishment is significantly less. But I'm pretty sure it's thousands of dollars of fines and many years in jail if it's the vehicular homicide one. And so what his bill does is it says if you were using a cell phone to make a phone call, I think he adds texting in here too, which I'm not really here to discuss because I still think that texting and driving should be illegal. But he's talking about if you're using a cell phone without a hands-free device and you cause an accident and someone dies because of that accident, you're guilty of vehicular homicide. But if you were using a hands-free device, you're scot-free.
That's weird.
That I thought was weird. I also think it's draconian because it's the exact same punishment you get. It adds it to the list of things. And one of the things in the list is if you're over the legal limit, if you blow over a 0.08. So we're basically equating holding a phone to your cheek,
telling your wife when you're going to be home.
Yes.
To driving drunk.
Being liquored up and driving. And from personal experience, I've never drunk and drove, but I have gone to the bar and had one and then drove home. And, you know, we all know it's not quite the same. And from personal experience, that's not even close. Like, that's not even in the same ballpark of, you know, having your reaction time slowed, in comparison to holding a phone to your cheek and telling your wife you're going to be home.
Yeah, there are a couple of different aspects of this that very much rub me the wrong way. One is what you articulate, which is that you're throwing things into the same basket, which really have no business being there. And at the same time, through omission, excluding a whole bunch of stuff that could be even more distracting than simply being on the phone talking to someone. I mean, the types of things that people do in their cars all the time, dealing with their kids, dealing with
life. Oh, yeah.
Back, you know, eating is a thing.
Reaching for the headset.
Reaching for the headset.
I used to use a headset driving my car. A lot. And yeah, there'd be times where, you know, I think I almost left the lane reaching for the headset.
And it's also very much open. This creates a scenario, effectively, in my view, whereby the police can pull you over at will. Because all they have to say is, oh, I thought he was texting, or oh, I thought he was on the phone. I saw a phone in his hand. And that's just their license to pull over anyone for any reason. And if you're one of these folks who's concerned about social justice issues and the way that minority groups are treated by
police,
then this should be of interest to you because now police are going to be able to pull over. All they'll have to say is, oh, I saw a phone. They won't have to have any other excuse whatsoever for pulling somebody over, even if their actual reason was, I don't like the color of his skin.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, we're giving police another reason to pull people over for activity that's not measurably dangerous for measurably more dangerous than the one we're sanctioning in these bills, which is the hands-free device con. And at that point, on this note, I'd like to go into this fact sheet that I've put together that we're putting out as the Republican Liberty Caucus. It's shared on our Facebook page. And I'm just going to read some of the important parts of it. And something that I think applies, you know, some logic that we can use with the general public and with anybody. So, according to numerous studies, banning non-hands-free cell phone calling while driving has no measurable effect of lowering automobile accident rates. Some of these studies are even done by insurance groups who have a vested financial interest in lowering accident rates. This is because hands-free calling and non-hands-free calling use nearly equal brain resources and are thus equally distracting. This is the position of the National Safety Council, and many studies support this conclusion. It lists 30 studies in the article that I read about this that say hands-free is no safer. Any bill that punishes people for calling while driving without a hands-free device is not going to save lives. We're not going to save lives here. We're not saving lives. And or reduce accidents, but will arbitrarily punish and fine people for calling in a manner that is no more dangerous than with a hands-free device, which would be permitted in all of these bills. Because this is basically what all these bills are doing, is permitting people to call with a hands-free device. And another thing that's suggested kind of in this article about that cites the National Safety Council, and I'll read a quick quote here. Well, many drivers honestly believe that they are making the safe choice by using a hands-free device. It's just not true. The problem is that the brain does not truly multitask. The danger in using cell phones, and don't get me wrong, like using a cell phone and having a conversation while you're driving does detract from your ability to drive an automobile. I was actually tempted to call up somebody on my way here, but I was in traffic on I-94 between Minneapolis and St. Paul, and I thought, you know, this is not a good place.
Mm-hmm.
Not a good place to have that conversation. Now, on a country road in western Minnesota, perfect place.
And just as a quick aside, that's one of the points that's completely missing from this type of debate, is the discernment, capacity of the individual driver to, in their own judgment, assess their risk. And indeed, if they make the wrong assessment and they end up killing somebody, I'm all for, let's get the vehicular homicide thing going. But to proactively say, we're just going to, across the board, pull over the person who's on that country road just to raise revenue is...
Yeah, that's
morally repugnant.
That's bad. And like I said, you know, the reason that it's not any safer is because you're using equal brain resources on the conversation, and that's what's taking most of your brain resources away from driving. Holding the phone up to your cheek, that's not taking any real amount of brain resources, no more than holding that other hand up to the steering wheel.
Right.
It's the conversation that you're having that's distracting you from driving. And if you're in a high traffic situation, you shouldn't call anybody anyway at all. Like this morning, I don't know if I mentioned this, but this morning when I drove to work, you know, it was icy. And there's lots of things that distract you when you're driving your car. I didn't even have the radio on.
Right.
And I had both hands on the wheels because I knew the conditions weren't good, and I wanted all my brain power and everything on my driving.
Yeah, people have often joked about how, you know, you'll turn off the radio when you're getting towards your destination so that you can hear your way to the destination better. Hmm. But it's true. When you're getting off the freeway and you're actually getting to where you want to go and you're looking for like a place to park or whatever, your tendency is to turn off the radio.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's just that you need more of that bandwidth to focus on the task of driving.
Yep. 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 Absolutely. No.
So let me ask you this, because we're a little bit short on time in this segment. In your view, if there's no evidence that this is actually going to have a real tangible effect upon public safety, and that is, you know, making it more illegal to drive while distracted and fining people more, then what's the impetus behind doing it? Why do they want to do it?
I honestly think it's kind of similar to gun control. It's grandstanding, and we want people to think that we're going to save lives. And it's just, you know, and I understand this, because with both issues, there's these horrible tragedies that have happened. You know, the shootings, and then with the driving, you know, people were on the side of the road and somebody was driving distracted and they went way over the line and hit somebody and killed somebody.
Yeah.
And it's sad and it's awful. And my hearts go out to these families. But what we're doing in both instances is we're taking the rage from that, and we're just going after law-abiding citizens.
We're punishing innocent people.
We're taking away people's... What we're doing in both instances is we're taking away people's liberty in ways that aren't going to solve the problem. And that's bad. And that's really how we lose our freedom, if you think about it, in many ways, is something awful happens. I could tie this back to 9/11, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, something awful happens, and our reaction is often not very rational, the things that we do take away people's liberty and don't actually solve the problem. You know, what I think we should do is we need to do education. We need to inform people that they need to get off the phone. It's not safe to drive when you're to be on the phone when you're in traffic. It's absolutely never safe to text and drive. And a bunch of these studies even say that the voice to text is not safe. Some of them even say it's more dangerous than button pressing texting, because you're composing messages, then you're probably looking them over to see that they're correct. If you're thinking about texting and driving, don't call and leave a message. And you know what? Most of the voicemails these systems these days will turn that into text for you, and then you can blame the other person when it goofs up the you know what you were trying to say.
Well, and here's an aspect of this that's also not at all a part of the discourse, certainly at the Capitol, that's taking place on this issue, and that's the commercial uses of these technologies. My day job is one where I engage in transportation. I'm in the shipping business, for a better term.
Okay.
And my phone is it's kind of like Uber.
Yeah.
It's and Uber drivers are another example. Critical function.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, I got an Uber ride the other day on Saturday, And I messaged my driver while he was on his way to pick me up, and he messaged me back. Now, I guarantee you he didn't pull over and sit there on his shoulder to send that message.
Yeah.
Now, that type of interaction, whether we're willing to admit it or not, happens every single day.
It does.
It happens all the time without anybody getting hurt and without anybody getting killed.
Generally,
And you can make whatever argument you want to make about how safe or unsafe it is. The fact of the matter is, it's something that is a integral part of people's commercial activity today. And if this bill passes, you're effectively making these legitimate commercial activities subject to being preyed upon by law enforcement.
No, that's absolutely true. And I actually do that too in my daily life. I dispatch technicians as a service manager, and I'm always calling them, asking them, hey, where are you? What's going on? This and that.
Right.
Hey, can you turn around and go back? It quit working right after you left. You know, that sort of thing.
And so, as you know, in that type of business, you can't pull over every time somebody makes a phone call like that, right? Like the idea that I'm going to wait 20 minutes or however long it takes me to get to my destination to get the news that I missed something and that I needed to turn around, like, this is completely unrealistic. And that type of the ways in which this kind of one size fits all legislative fix to problems affects people's actual day-to-day lives, that part of the conversation is completely missing because they're focused entirely on the here's my sob story.
Yeah.
Here's my picture of the loved one that I lost because, you know, somebody made a boneheaded move, and we make the legislative solution in order to appease that person, that survivor.
That's the worst way to legislate. I mean, it's tragic what has happened to these people, and there's things that need to be done, but legislating emotionally and in a reactionary fashion is usually a recipe for bad laws.
Let's pick up on that when we return, and I also want to get your thoughts on the special election that we have that's going to be decided tomorrow up north of us, involving Jason Rarick, who we had on the program last week. Closing argument, my name is Walter Hudson. Andrew Schmitz, Vice Chair of the Republican Liberty Caucus, in studio with us, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com.
Sean Hannity.
Fix the problem.
Sean.
Fix the problem.
We're talking about hands-free driving legislation that's making its way. There's a couple of different bills making their way through the Senate. We're talking about with Andrew Schmitz, Vice Chair of the Republican Liberty Caucus. Closing argument, my name is Walter Hudson, 651-989-5855, the number to join us. John Augustine, who is involved with the Legislative Evaluation Assembly, an organization that puts out a legislative scorecard after each session, conservative group, constitutional group, had a Facebook post a couple of hours ago where he disclosed an aspect of this story that's probably overlooked, and that is he says there are unwritten standards of allowable conduct at Minnesota legislative hearings. For generations, the standards have not allowed testifiers or audience members to make a visual demonstration using banners, protest signs, poster-sized photos, or other displays distinct from personal clothing. Last month, in the transportation committees of the House and Senate, the chairman of these committees, who also happened to be the chief authors of this year's bills banning handheld cell phone use by drivers, secured an exception to the standards, which allowed advocates to display large photos of family members that had been killed or irreparably harmed in accidents linked to distracted driving. So, Andrew, you know, clearly this is a move to take away from the sobriety and rational judgment that is supposedly supposed to inform these deliberations of public policy and effectively allow for political protest inside the hearing rooms. Not surprising, but not encouraging.
Not really surprising. Although, I mean, I wouldn't want to be the bailiff that has to take away the sign, to be honest. If we enforce the rules. So I can sympathize with them a little bit, but I think it just goes back to my point that we're making these laws, or we're writing and passing these laws, emotionally, and we're kind of shoving, you know, rationality and, you know, good analysis out the window. And I think that's just another, you know, sign of what's going on here.
So you've talked about the kind of the education that you would like to see happen in lieu of passing this type of legislation. In our last segment here tonight on this issue, kind of wrap it up and give us your summary of what RLC is proposing.
So, absolutely. I mean, if there's all sorts of educational things you can do. I mean, you can do ads. One of the worst things that you can do, though, on the education end of it is tell people, you know, with effectively what these laws are doing is that, hey, it's safe to use a hands-free device when you're calling.
Right.
Because it's not. I mean, you're these laws, what they want to pass is effectively miseducating people. It's never truly, you know, safe to call and drive. But it's sort of a risk management that you have to make in your life, just like it's never truly safe to change the volume on the radio or the station.
It's never truly safe to get out of bed in the morning.
It's never truly safe to drive. I mean, if we really wanted to end all the traffic deaths, right? That's true. If we wanted to end all the traffic, you know, most of the traffic deaths, let's lower all the speed limits to 25 miles an hour.
Right.
I mean, everything in life is a risk management decision. And you know, we at the Liberty Caucus err on the side of liberty, and we're absolutely against taking away people's liberty for something that is not going to save lives. Like I've said, all these insurance company funded, you know, the people that have invested interest in cutting down the accidents so they don't have to pay out claims, their studies are saying, yeah, we can't measure any state where we're passing these laws lowered accident rates, and the research institutions say, yeah, that's because using a hands-free device is just as distracting, and you're not making it any better. So taking away people's liberty and criminalizing regular activity to accomplish absolutely nothing, and yeah, that's something that the RLC is absolutely against, and I think it's truly tragic that this is where our legislature, and more specifically, this is where our Republican caucuses, or many large parts of them, are going.
Yeah, I should work on getting Osmek onto the show, because, you know, I've been over this air with him in the past, and I generally regard him to be a pretty decent guy. I would love to know what he's thinking on this, and what his reasoning
well,
is.
Well, if you bring him on, bring up the point that hands-free calling is absolutely no safer, and ask him why he arbitrarily allows that.
All right, sounds good to me. So before we let you go tonight, I wanted to get your thoughts on this special election that we have going up in District 11, Senate District 11 up there around the Pine City and Hinckley area, involving Jason Rarick, who we had on the show last week. He's a current state representative from that area on the B side, I believe. And he's going up against a legacy candidate, third generation family member. So you've been up there. You've been door knocking. What's the feel up in that area as to what's going to take place tomorrow?
Well, I was door knocking up there one day, and I had a wonderful time up there, actually, door knocking with the young Republicans. Quite a bit of fun. I talked to a couple voters. I had a long conversation with one of them. The feeling I get, especially from talking to that one, is that the people up there are changing their voting patterns, and they're voting a lot more Republican. They don't have the Trump hate that people have down here in the metro. I had at least two people that I door knocked that were listed in our data as either hard or soft Democrats, and they said, yeah, without hesitation, they're voting for Rarick, the Republican. And I said Rarick was the Republican. It's not surprising to me at all. And there was one guy who I had an extended conversation with in his yard, in a farmyard, and he was telling me that, yeah, I used to vote Democrat all the time. I used to always vote Democrat, but man, I can't believe where they're going. They're just leaving us behind. They just don't seem to care about us. And of course, the Democrats constantly say that they care, but they don't understand the things that people out there actually care about.
Yeah,
so they can't really connect with them. And he was also very upset with the way that they've treated Trump. You know, I said, you know, the guy's kind of a loudmouth, but Jesus, you know, the things that they're saying about the president and the way they're attacking him, it just disgusts him. So I think we have a really good chance at winning this race. The electoral trends are going in our favor up here. Obviously, they're going in the opposite direction down in places like Edina.
Right.
But that's my analysis on it. If you're wondering about the history of this, if the Democrat gets elected, Stu Laurie, he'll be the third generation in his family to hold this seat. I was told his grandmother picked it up in the 90s. Then his dad took over, Tony Laurie, who got appointed into the Walz administration. And so he'll be sort of the third generation to get this seat if he gets it. He's actually a Carleton grad. I don't know if any of your listeners know anything about Carleton College, but I don't know anyone that went there that isn't a super hard lefty. That's like the most leftist institution in the state.
Aren't the Democrats the ones who are always talking about how we need to have more state taxes, and it's such a pity that people inherit their wealth, and you know that this whole idea of legacies and sons inheriting things from their fathers and whatnot is bad? Aren't we supposed to do away with that?
I don't know. They're always talking about how we're not supposed to have this generational whatever I can't remember. I know there's a term, but I know what you're saying.
All right, Andrew Schmitz, the Republican Liberty Caucus, rlcmn.org, still the website?
Yeah, no, now it's rlcminnesota.org.
rlcminnesota.org.
You got to say RLC, Republican Liberty Caucus, and then spell out the state of Minnesota.org.
All right, sounds good. We'll be back to talk about all sorts of things. A governor who's being called to resign, not because he wants to kill babies, which he does, but because he was in a photo dressed as Michael Jackson at some point years ago. That sounds like modern America. My name is Walter Hatson, 651-989-5855. Closing argument, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. List of articles here citing examples of how the Democrats are out of their mind and are seeking to eat the rich. They just want to consume them. They just want to put them in their mouths and chew them, digest them, and be done with them. And for its own sake, it's as we get into this, it's very clear that the utility of eating the rich has nothing whatsoever to do with actually benefiting anyone else at all. Like, it's not redistributive. This isn't a way to affect social justice in the way that the left articulates it. It's just a way to get revenge on people for being wealthy, to punish people for having what you don't have, for tearing people down for being successful. That's the objective. And yet, the punchline here is they're succeeding. Like, they are actually moving the needle on this. And we need to stop and pause and be a little introspective and ask ourselves, how are they winning this battle? Because there's some accountability that we need to face on that. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hatson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Streaming at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and your iHeartRadio app. We're here 8 to 10 weeknights. It's great having you with us. You can join us at 651-989-5855. Brad Omland taking those calls and producing the show. Let's talk to John in Coon Rapids. Welcome to the program.
Hey, Walter.
Hey.
I just wanted to say I appreciate everything you do, and I agree with all your points. And I just, wanted to say I appreciate you. And I'm having a hard time just accepting that they're even being listened to or taken seriously at all. And I grew up in a family of lifelong Democrats, and I found myself on my own coming to the conservative side by listening to Rush and,
being somebody who
have a little bit of common sense, it just makes sense. I mean, I'm not understanding anything the Democrats are doing.
So I don't want you to throw your family under the bus on the air, but what's your sense of why they are lifelong Democrats?
Well, I think it has to do with the entitlement and maybe growing up in poverty and wanting, I guess, the welfare state. And I think, Minnesota just being a Democratic state for so long, Yeah, I don't really understand it myself because I try to argue the conservative points with them, mm-hmm. and they're unreceptive whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate your call, John. Appreciate you listening. Thanks for joining us on the program. From Reuters, U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders sent a letter to Catalyst Pharmaceuticals on Monday asking it to justify its decision to charge $375,000 annually for a medication that for years has been available to patients for free. Now, just this opening paragraph, I mean, just this opening paragraph, you have to read the whole thing to really get the full context of what's going on here. But I'll tell you what, if I was the CEO of Catalyst Pharmaceuticals, and I received this letter, and this is, by the way, one of the many reasons why I'm not the CEO of a pharmaceutical company or any other corporation, is for what I'm about to say here. If I was the CEO of Catalyst Pharmaceuticals, I would write a letter back to U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders. It would be properly formatted on the fanciest paper I could possibly purchase. You know, it'd have my address up there at the top. It would be, you know, however you're supposed to address him, the Honorable Senator Bernie Sanders from Vermont or, you know, wherever he's from. And my answer would be, because we own it, period. Sincerely, Walter Hudson, CEO of Catalyst Pharmaceuticals. Because that's the entire answer. I need to justify to you my decision to charge a price for a product that I'm offering on the market. I own it. The end. That's my entire justification. Now, you argue against that, because that's what Bernie Sanders has to do. Bernie Sanders and his fellow socialists, Democratic socialists like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who, you know, we'll touch upon here in a moment, they need to argue against ownership. Or at least it would be nice if they had to acknowledge that that's what they're arguing against. And the only way they're ever going to do that is if we force them to, if we put them in the funnel of acknowledging that you are, by telling me the audacity of asking me to justify why I set a price for a product that I'm bringing to market, where do you get the authority, or on what standing do you even ask the question? That's the question that ought to be asked back to Bernie Sanders. But of course, you know, that's living in a fantasy world to imagine that that would happen, especially by anybody who calls themselves a journalist. The drug in question is called Firdapse. I'm not sure how it's pronounced. It's used to treat Lambert-Eaton myasthenic syndrome. It's called LEMS, a rare neuromuscular disorder, according to the letter made available to Reuters by the senator's office. The disorder affects about 1 in 100,000 people in the United States. The government is intensifying its scrutiny of the pharmaceutical industry and rising prescription drug prices, a top voter concern and a priority of President Donald Trump's administration. So this is bipartisan. You know, that's one thing, you know, coming out of our discussion regarding the hands-free bills that are making their ways through the state legislature here in Minnesota. This is another example of an area where Republicans suddenly find themselves abandoning their quote-unquote free market principles when it comes to something that's politically palpable, like quote-unquote controlling pharmaceutical prices. Both the Democratic-led U.S. House of Representatives and the Senate, controlled by Republicans, have been holding hearings this year on the rising costs of medicines. Sanders is an independent who usually votes with the Democrats. In his letter dated February 4th, Sanders asked Catalyst to lay out the financial and non-financial factors that led the company to set a list price at $375,000 and say how many patients would suffer or die as a result of the price and how much it was paying to purchase or produce the drug. Now, here's another question that ought to be addressed. You know, as long as we're coming up with things, as long as we're putting things in Catalyst's lap that they have to do because the senator wrote them a letter, how about we list all the people who would have suffered and died if this drug never existed? Because that's the direction where we're going with this. When you get to the point where government gets to intervene in the setting of prices and the dictating of terms and whether or how products come to market, eventually what you're going to do is, because the answer to the question in brief, other than they own it and could set whatever price they want, the reason why they're setting a price of $375,000 annually for this prescription drug is because that's what it cost. That's what the price that they have to set in order to make a profit, which is why they're in business. And if they're not making a profit, then there's no reason for them to be in business with this particular product, which means the product is not going to exist. So, again, it goes back to a question of ownership, and ultimately not even just ownership of the product, but ownership of the lives of the people involved in producing the product. Why does anybody produce a drug in the first place? It's not out of sheer benevolence. It's not out of charity. It's because they see a need in the market, and they're willing to invest capital and time in the production of a solution, and they deserve, if the value is actually there, if it actually does treat the disease in question, they deserve to be compensated for it. For years, and this is the aspect of this that is conspicuously missing from the first paragraph of this article. For years, patients have been able to get the same drug for free. Here they utilize that terminology again, for free, from Jacobus Pharmaceuticals, a small New Jersey-based drug company, which offered it through a U.S. Food and Drug Administration program called Compassionate Use. So this is like two or three times at this point in the article where they've referred to people getting this drug for free prior to this company taking ownership of it and setting a price for it. But that's not true. Nobody was getting it for free. You and I were paying for it with our federal tax dollars. Now, if you're for that, then fantastic. Make the argument for that. However, don't tell me that people were getting it for free, because they weren't. When I'm paying for it and you're paying for it and the federal government is paying for it, that's the only reason why it existed. And so what is Sanders actually proposing here? Like, what's he suggesting? That this company should just give away their drug without any sort of compensation whatsoever? Is that the point where we're at? This is only the first example. From Sean Hannity, Hannity.com. Our own Ilhan Omar doubled down on her proposed tax hike over the weekend, saying a marginal tax rate of 70 to 92% on wealthy Americans is a necessary tool to finance Medicare for All, the Green New Deal, and student loan debt forgiveness. So, you know, 70 to 92% tax. This is, of course, Omar competing with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez to see who can be the most radical, who can be the craziest in terms of their proposals. From the Cato Institute, Kamala Harris admits Medicare for All would kill private health insurance. Of course, so would a public option, which is, you know, the other thing that's being floated. And the interesting thing, the vital thing articulated in this Cato article, is they discuss the fact that this Medicare for All proposal is being offered as an opening negotiating position so that they can negotiate back to this so-called public option. Now, you'll recall that the public option, a public insurance plan, a single-payer insurance plan, was something that was offered during the Obamacare debate as an opening negotiating position to get us back to Obamacare. This is how the Democrats work. This is why you see them out there right now talking about 90% tax, 70% tax. They'll be happy with 50, 40, 60, somewhere in that zone, and they'll be able to present that as some sort of grand compromise and present themselves as reasonable statesmen for walking back from their original 70, 90% tax proposal down to like 65 or 55 or whatever it ends up being. And, you know, we've been talking a lot. We've been hammering Republicans a lot lately on the program for their seeming inability to do this sort of thing. This is what you have to be willing to do this. If you actually want to advance an agenda, you have to be willing to put forth bold, unobtainable ideas and set the bar way out there. Now, Trump is doing this to a large extent on the border stuff with his wall, although I think he actually does want a wall. But the point is, Trump does this kind of thing all the time. That's one of the things that differentiates him from most other Republicans, is that he's actually willing to put forth a bold proposal out there and then walk it back in order to compromise it, because he knows that that's how you advance the course of legislation in the direction you want to see it go. But Democrats have been doing this stuff for years. And because Republicans are unwilling to do the unequal and opposite, let alone better job in the other direction, this is why we're incrementally inching further and further and further to the left. And it goes beyond that, though. It goes beyond that. We're at the point now, because it's not just the politics and the legislation that shifts. It's the Overton window. It's the overall cultural perception of what is acceptable. Recall that Hillary Clinton, when she tried to promote Hillary Care back during her husband's administration, was laughed off the public stage and thought of as being somebody who was promoting a ridiculous and completely unpalatable and unrealistic proposal. Decade or so later, we had Obamacare. And now we're talking about Medicare for all and a public option. So not so crazy anymore, right? That's because the public's idea of what is and is not acceptable has radically shifted. And it's continuing to radically shift. Well, guess what? As crazy as Ilhan Omar and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Kamala Harris and Bernie Sanders are when they propose these things, people agree with them. And there's polling to prove it. And by people, I include Republicans. Not Republican legislators, not Republican politicians, Republican voters, perhaps even some of you listening. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. You know, we often hear, and it's very popular, when people are writing about politics and talking about politics, appeals to the majority. You know, the majority of Americans are for, fill in the blank. Majority of Americans are against that proposal that was just raised. But of course, majorities for or against a thing or a person or a candidate onto themselves without any context are pretty meaningless, right? Like this idea that, and really the rhetorical trick that's being played there is people are appealing to this notion of pure democracy, that if a majority of people generally think one way or the other, then that's the way we ought to go. Which, of course, is a logical fallacy. It's not an argument. But it's effective. It's an effective piece of rhetoric. In politics, what a majority of people think on an issue, or what a majority of people approve of or disapprove of, is only relevant to the voting interest concerned. So in other words, you know, when you're looking at something like the presidential election, like you'll hear a lot right now about how Trump's numbers are bad. You know, his approval rating last I saw was somewhere in the mid to low 30s, which of course is horrific, right? However, that ultimately doesn't matter. What matters is how many people, one, are going to come out to vote on both sides, and in which states, because as it turns out, who gets to be the president of the United States is not determined by a poll of the general population. It's determined by the number of people who come out and cast a ballot in these several states and the majorities in those several states and what the Electoral College adds up to. That's how the president is determined. And in a similar fashion, you know, when you're talking about issues where people are on something like taxes, or you know, various spending programs or policy positions, you know, abortion, whatever the issue may be, what the quote unquote the people think is not necessarily going to be determinative of the policy that you end up getting out the other end of the legislative process. And that is something that is noted in a piece by the Washington Post that tries to get after the real reason, what they put forward as the real reason why Republicans are so off-put by proposals such as the ones we discussed in the last segment. You know, Senator Bernie Sanders talking about how he is demanding that a pharmaceutical company justify their price for a product. The likes of Ocasio-Cortez and our own Ilhan Omar putting forward propositions of taxing people 70 to 90% of their income. You know, Kamala Harris talking about Medicare for all. What they cite here at the Washington Post, not entirely without merit, is that the real concern is that when people hear these proposals, they might actually go along with them. And there's polling to that effect, specifically when it comes to taxes. Another piece of the Washington Post. Critics of Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez have lined up to paint her proposed 70% tax rate on income above $10 million as extreme, unrealistic, and not in line with what voters want, But a new Fox News poll, of all places, finds that raising income taxes on decamillionaires, people who make more than $10,000, is a policy that enjoys broad bipartisan support among 85% of Democrats, 54% of Republicans, and 70% of registered voters overall. 70%. That's a supermajority, folks. Hiking taxes on income over over $1 million was almost as popular overall, with 65% support. Asked in broad terms to choose between cutting taxes or raising spending, a majority of Americans opted for the latter, with only 40% preferring tax cuts. So, people love them their spending, right? Love that government spending. And so, you know, what this presents is a bit of a crisis for those of us who actually care about this fiscal responsibility stuff. And I know there's not a whole lot of people that fit in that category out there anymore, but we used to at least talk about it, right? We had this whole thing, this whole movement called the Tea Party that was kind of a big deal about 10 years ago or so, that one of the chief planks of which was fiscal responsibility. I mean, the tagline, TEA, taxed enough already. It's what everybody chanted. It's what they had on their signs as they were marching in rallies. And it seemed to be a pretty big concern for folks. But that's all changed, apparently. Now, 54% of Republicans are cool with taxing people who make a lot of money up to 70, 75, 90% of their income. Now, here's the thing. One of these pieces, I don't know if this one I'm looking at right now tells it. I saw a number in another article last week that was talking about one of these proposals involving taxing the rich, and they said that they were going to be able to raise somewhere in the area of $350 billion by taxing income, and I forget over what period of time. And you know, that's a number that has to be placed into context, right? So you've got this apple out there that you can take a bite out of, this apple known as the rich, the mega rich, the deca billionaires. And you could take a big bite out of that apple, take a huge amount of their income, raise, I don't know, $1/3 of $1 trillion, $1/3 of $1 trillion from doing that. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's proposed Medicare for All plan, and, you know, by the way, it's not exclusively hers. Kamala Harris can fit in this boat. Any Democrat who talks about Medicare for All has been judged in bipartisan fashion on the low end, on the conservative end, to cost $32 trillion over 10 years. 10 years. So, you know, long enough for somebody born today to reach 10 years old, right? And that's it. And then the $32 million is spent. It's gone. Or $32 trillion, I should say. Spent, gone, you're done. You're out of health care at that point. $32 trillion. So what are we going to accomplish by taxing the ultra-wealthy, the deca billionaires, that $350 billion? How, that doesn't even put a dent. It's not even a drop in the ocean of the amount of money that's required to pay for just one of the Democrats' proposed programs. So what this tells you, it tells you a lot of things. But the one I want to focus on for right now is that the point of taxing the rich has nothing whatsoever to do with actually providing anything for anyone whatsoever. It's not about paying for Medicare for All, because it doesn't. It's not about impacting the national debt, because it won't. It's not about being fiscally responsible, because it's not. It's about one thing and one thing only, and that's cannibalism. It's about eating the rich. It's about punishing people for being wealthy. It's about that scene in The Dark Knight Rises where they're rooting through people's, you know, mansions, tearing things down, throwing things out windows, and dragging people through the streets and making them walk out on the ice, and then applauding as they crash through to their deaths. It's about the French Revolution and breaking out the guillotines. 651-989-5855. Closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk. AM 1130, 103.5 FM. TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. Two trailer park girls go round the outside, round the outside, round the outside. sometimes I look at developments in the news and I find myself struggling to take them seriously and pausing to actively wonder whether or not I'm awake. Like, is this really happening? Is this a real thing? Are we actually experiencing this right now? On Thursday, I spent a significant portion of the show talking about the issue of abortion, which is something that we hadn't really done before, not certainly not to the extent that we talked about it on Thursday. And one of the key impetuses for talking about that, for making it an issue on the program, was the news from last week regarding the governor of Virginia, Ralph Northam, who was caught. But, you know, in order to be caught doing something, you have to, first of all, be trying to hide it, and two, be ashamed of it. And neither of those things apply to Ralph Northam. So it's not accurate for me to say he was caught on a hot mic saying something incendiary and outlandish. No, he proudly and without apology defended infanticide. And that's not an exaggeration. He quite literally defended the hypothetical situation that could develop under a bill that's being considered in his state, whereby a baby, a human child, could be born and then, as he put it, made comfortable while mom and the doctor have a conversation in the other room about whether or not to murder it. That's what he said last week. Now, for about a week, those comments kind of percolated. And, you know, a few people, such as myself, expressed extreme outrage, justifiable, meritorious, righteous indignation in response to this articulation of evil and condemned it as such. But you know who was conspicuously silent and even largely aligned with Northam's rhetoric? The entire Democratic Party. The entire Democratic Party, from top to bottom, from the activists all the way up to the chair and all of the elected officials and incumbents. No problem whatsoever with infanticide. No problem whatsoever with let's kill babies outside the womb. I mean, why not? There's really no difference between that and what we're doing already anyway, which is true. It's true. That caused no outrage whatsoever. But then, over the weekend, now all of a sudden, the Democrats do want Northam to resign. He's a pariah now within their party. Now, did it just take them a week to realize that he's for baby murder? No. No, in fact, their reason for wanting him to resign has nothing whatsoever to do with his position on abortion. He committed a truly heinous crime, a truly unforgivable sin. You see, advocating for the murder of children is perfectly acceptable and even expected within the Democratic Party. But what you can't do, what you can never, ever, ever do in a million years without bringing upon unending shame and scorn and reproach from your Democratic neighbors, is be a white guy who dresses like a black guy. A white guy who shows up at a Halloween party dressed up as Michael Jackson. A white guy who in any way whatsoever engages in blackface. This is the sin to end all sins. Baby murder, that's fine. But blackface, get out.
There was a scene yesterday. I was watching the NFL Network in the afternoon before the Super Bowl. And there was a scene where Steve Mariucci, was the former 49ers head coach, was dressed up like a black record producer, like you might see like Flava Flav dressed up as, with like the leather fedora and the big glasses, right, with the, right, gold on the side.
Right.
I was like, is there going to be blowback on this? Because it was clearly like he was trying to be black.
Sure.
And because they were, you know, talking about the Atlanta hip hop scene and kind of,
yeah,
making a stupid fake hip hop song, but
right.
It was clearly like, whoa, he's dressed up as someone he's not.
And can we just pause to note that the fact that you had that reaction, and I've had similar reactions nowadays when I see things, not because I'm offended by them, not because I think they're inappropriate, but because it's that sense of, ooh, somebody's going to be mad at this.
Yeah.
That the fact that we even have that impulse is a damning testament to the direction the culture has gone. We are all less funny. We are all less capable of having fun as a result of the direction the culture has gone in this regard. But be that as it may, you know, Matt Walsh, of course, in a remarkable fashion, goes off on this contrast between Democrats being completely fine with Northam's comments, advocating for infanticide, but having their ire provoked because of a 30-year-old photo of him in an inappropriate costume. And there's, you know, pieces out of Reuters and more mainstream publications where they're hemming and hawing and wringing their hands over his admissions and then retractions of his admissions and then his trying to kind of parse through the details and explain himself and defend himself. And he's been a little awkward. And I just look at it all mouth agape. Like, really? Like, we're having this conversation. We're really engaged in a national discourse over a dude's Michael Jackson Halloween costume in lieu of his advocacy for baby murder. Like, clearly, the blackface thing is more important in the eyes of at least half the country, if not more. And, you know, again, I'll say the same thing that I said last Thursday when we talked about abortion for the majority of the show, which is I see these types of things and I find myself in awe of God's capacity to stay his hand. Like the fact that the asteroid doesn't hit, the fact that another flood doesn't come, that he reneges on the rainbow promise, right? Especially in lieu of how that symbol has been perverted, right? If the fact that he doesn't decide to pull the trigger, metaphorically, on human civilization is awe-inspiring and astounding, and I don't know how he does it. Because what an incredible insult to all that is good and decent and holy and righteous for a culture to be up in arms and inflamed and you know, motivated to incendiary action and rhetoric and concern, all-consuming concern, over a 30-year-old photo of a white guy dressed as a black guy while completely apathetic and non-concerned with the death of millions of children every year. But that's where we're at. 651-989-5855. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk. AM 1130, 103.5 FM. TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com.
Barbara Streisand.
So, we've known for quite some time that unemployment statistics and government statistics generally are a little misleading. But there's a new insight that's articulated here at Business Insider that I found particularly provocative and illuminating. I want to share it with you here on Closing Argument. My name is Walter Hudson. 651-989-5855 if you want to shoehorn in a comment here before the end of the show. In brief, unemployment, official unemployment numbers, are at a record low both in the UK and the United States, but something they're calling involuntary part-time work is at least 40% higher in both countries than it was 10 years ago. Now, what does that even mean? Involuntary part-time work. Like, is somebody taking a gun and pointing at people's heads and enslaving them for half the day or 3 days a week?
Yes.
Actually, that's metaphorically correct. You're actually onto something there, but you're getting ahead of us. It's involuntary in the sense that people would rather be working full-time, but they're working part-time because that's all the work they can find. The structure of the labor market, this is again from Business Insider, has fundamentally changed, and what we used to think of as unemployment has been replaced by mass part-time work, much of it unwanted. The gig economy, you know, things such as Uber and what have you, jobs are to blame, according to Rob Valletta of the San Francisco Fed. And, you know, that's pretty much the key insight from this. You know, they go into a lot of other less profound analysis and kind of centered around what the Federal Reserve should do. And they talk a lot about interest rates. But to me, none of that is particularly compelling or interesting.
Or true.
What's interesting to me, well, expound upon that.
He's blaming Uber for more companies having part-time jobs. It's the complete opposite. The reason why things like Uber, Lyft, Amazon Prime, other, you know, gig economy type jobs are flourishing is because of the government regulations that exist that create the only part-time jobs.
Right.
For example, the healthcare regulation that says if you work more than, 32 hours a week,
yep,
you are required to have healthcare offered by your employer.
Yep.
Guess what? Employers just stop offering 32 hours a week.
That's right. That's right.
So that, like, because there's more of a demand for those Uber type jobs where it's flexible and you can kind of get that 10 to 15 hours a week that you're missing, people are going to work those jobs.
Now, listen, I'm not telling you that I'm particularly interested in having a 3-hour show as opposed to a 2-1, certainly under the current conditions on which this show operates. But I can tell you with a certain degree of certainty that the reason why it's not 3 hours as opposed to 2 is for that very reason. At that point, I would be a full-time employee. And that would open Pandora's box of regulation. And that's not a price that they're willing to pay. At that point, the show's not worth it for iHeart anymore. And that's an example from yours truly. It involves Brad as well, obviously. But that same type of situation, there are millions of people who find themselves in that situation where they're working part-time, not because there isn't a economic need for a full-time job, but because the cost of being the employer of a full-time employee is so much higher than being the employer of several part-time employees.
Well, and it works both ways, too, especially in lower-wage jobs. For example, when I was working for an unnamed retailer in town, they would always cut hours in the third quarter,
right,
to save money for labor costs for the holiday season. And what that meant for me, being a part-time worker there, was I got more hours.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes close to 40 hours, because my average hourly or my average weekly hours was not 32 and was never going to be, even if I was getting 40 hours a week for 4 weeks out of the year.
Right.
And so the people who were full-time and actually did want to work full-time and wanted healthcare,
mm-hmm,
in those weeks got their hours cut because of that same,
right,
notion.
And the point there is that nobody's getting what they want. And that's what they talk about that in this article, but they never get after the why, right? Nobody's getting what they want out of this economy. And it's not, in spite of the quote unquote good numbers, good earnings, good unemployment numbers, statistical full employment. There are still a whole lot of people who aren't getting what they want out of the economy. And the reason they're not is because it's literally illegal for them to do so. You know, to Brad's point, you know, I joked around saying, well, do people have a gun pointed at their head forcing them to work part time? And Brad says, yep. Well, there's a truth to that.
You look at your taxes, 25% of your day is taken, yeah, out. 2 hours of your day you spend working for somebody else.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's true in a wide variety of ways. All the ways in which your capacity to produce value, number one, and then to keep it once you've made it, right, and to engage in trade, all the ways in which government interferes, mandates, regulates, controls, taxes, takes away from that capacity. And it has a real world effect upon people's lives, much more so than any of the things that typically get talked about or complained about in the typical public discourse. Speaking of public discourses, we're going to have one tomorrow night. We're going to have in studio with us Xavier Bickett, the chair of the Republican Liberty Caucus. We had Andrew Schmitz on the show earlier today, the vice chair, talking about hands-free bills. Tomorrow, Xavier is going to be in, along with the chair of the Libertarian Party of Minnesota, Chris Holbrook, and the two of them are going to help me analyze and break down the State of the Union that, of course, is due to be given by President Donald Trump to a joint session of Congress tomorrow night. I recall, in fact, it was the precursor to us going on the air for the first time on this show. Before Closing Argument debuted, we were on to cover Trump's first address to a joint session of Congress. It wasn't officially called the State of the Union because he hadn't been, they only call it that once he's been in office for a year. But it was his first joint address, and I liked it. I found there was a lot in there that I found very provocative and wish that he had campaigned accordingly and had governed accordingly. We'll see how we like tomorrow's address. Be sure to tune into it. I think it starts at 8 o'clock tomorrow night. We're here 8 to 10, so we'll be here to analyze it with you. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com.